Chapter 6. Other Geometries. Carl Friedrich Gauss, whom we encountered in Chapter 4 in our discussion of the Gaussian curvature, made important contributions outside geometry in just about every branch of mathematics. The Gauss lemma in number theory and Gaussian distributions in statistics, to name only two. Such a broad perspective from one mathematician has not been seen since the second half of the 20th century. It may be that we are just lacking geniuses of Gauss's calibre, but a more likely explanation is that mathematics has increasingly become too specialised for anyone to grasp it as a whole. Thousands of PhD students take 4 years to complete research projects, generalising research projects completed by their supervisors 20 years earlier. While this has led to some truly remarkable progress, it came at the price of introducing narrow specialisation, which makes it difficult for mathematicians to share their findings with non-specialists, or even among themselves. Geometry, which has been one of the fastest developing areas of mathematics, has not been immune to this. The Atiyah-Singer index theorem, proved in 1963 by Michael Atiyah and Isidore Singer, is one of the most celebrated results in geometry in the last 60 years. It roughly states that, for an elliptic differential operator on a compact manifold, the analytical index related to the dimension of the kernel of the operator is equal to the topological index. Let us not worry about the proof of this theorem and focus only on its statement. To make sense of it, you need to know the definition of compact manifolds, a final year differential geometry course at Cambridge, elliptic operators and their kernels, a second year analysis course, followed by a final year course in partial differential equations, and topological indices, which are not taught at an undergraduate level. This means that the best students who graduate with a mathematics degree from Cambridge are not capable of even understanding the statement of the Atiyah-Singer theorem. Note that this theorem was proved more than half a century ago. There have been hundreds of remarkable results established in geometry since then, which are accessible to only a handful of people. A researcher in algebraic geometry will struggle to follow a differential geometry lecture. Differential geometers will find it hard to make sense of non-commutative geometry, and so on. This chapter offers an overview of some of these modern geometries and their links with other areas of mathematics. Erlangen program. Two geometric shapes are congruent in Euclidean geometry if one of them can be moved into the other by translating, rotating, and reflecting it in space. For example, all squares of side 1 on the plane are congruent, and once we understand geometric properties of one of these squares, such as the distance between the opposite corners, or the area of an inscribed circle, we will not need to repeat the computations for any of the other squares. All such squares are the same, up to the congruence, and so are their properties. The program I shall now describe reverses this process, specifying a class of allowed transformations. The rotations and translations for Euclidean geometry allows us to define the geometry itself. Consider a transformation of the set of real numbers squared, plane, mapping a point capital P with coordinates x, y, to a point, the complement of capital P with coordinates, the complement of x, the complement of y, given by AF. The complement of x equals A times x plus B times y plus C. And the complement of y equals D times x plus E times y plus F, where the parameters of the transformation, A, B, C, D, E, F, are fixed real numbers, such that A times E minus B times D is not equal to zero. Such a transformation is called affine. The image of a straight line under an affine transformation is another straight line, and the order of points on the lines is preserved. The distance between points, however, is not preserved. To see it, take two points, capital P and capital Q, with coordinates 0, 0 and 0, 1, respectively, so that the distance D of capital P, capital Q, equals 1, and consider an affine transformation with A equals 1, B equals 0, C equals 1, D equals 0, E equals 2, F equals 0. We compute the coordinates of the transformed points, the complement of capital P and the complement of capital Q, to be 1, 0 and 1, 2, so that the distance D of capital P capital Q equals the square root of open parenthesis 1 minus 1 close parenthesis squared plus open parenthesis 2 minus 0 close parenthesis squared equals 2. The affine geometry is the study of those properties of geometric shapes which do not change under affine transformations. Affine transformations do not preserve distances or angles, but they map lines to lines and preserve parallelism, centroids of polygons, and the ratios of distances along parallel lines. So while a rectangle is not a well-defined object in affine geometry, a parallelogram is. Circles are mapped to ellipses by affine transformations, so conic sections are affine concepts, and moreover, ellipses are distinguished from hyperbolas. One of the theorems in Euclidean geometry that remains true in affine geometry is the Chaver theorem, named after the 17th century Italian mathematician Giovanni Chaver. The theorem was, however, already known to the 11th century Arab mathematician and king of Zaragoza, Yusuf al-Mutamman ibn Hud. The theorem states the following. Chaver's theorem. Let capital P, capital Q, and capital R be the points on the three sides, capital B, capital C, capital C, capital A, and capital A, capital B, of a triangle. Triangle capital A, capital B, capital C. Then the relation holds if and only if the three lines, capital A, capital P, capital B, capital Q, and capital C, capital R, intersect at one point, or are parallel. The fraction with the numerator, the absolute value of capital B, capital P, and the denominator with the absolute value capital P, capital C, times the fraction with the numerator, the absolute value of capital C, capital Q, and the denominator with the absolute value capital Q, capital A, times the fraction with the numerator, the absolute value capital A, capital R, and the denominator with the absolute value capital R, capital B, equals 1. Although the notion of the distance, for example, the absolute value of capital B, capital P, between the points capital B and capital P, appears in the statement of the theorem, the distances only enter as ratios. An affine transformation of the points capital A, capital B, capital C results in a triangle with different areas and angles. And yet if the same affine transformation is applied to the points capital P, capital Q and capital R, then the theorem still holds. If we take capital P, capital Q and capital R to be the midpoints of the sides of the triangle, then the absolute value of capital B, capital P, equals the absolute value of capital P, capital C. The absolute value of capital C, capital Q, equals the absolute value of capital Q, capital A. And the absolute value of capital A, capital R, equals the absolute value of capital R, capital B, which makes all the ratios in the Chaver formula equal to 1. We have therefore recovered a result which some listeners may recall from school geometry. If a median in a triangle is defined to be a line segment joining a vertex to the midpoint of the opposite side, then in any triangle, the three medians intersect at one point. A composition of two affine transformations is another affine transformation. This can be seen by applying the affine transformation AF with parameters A sub 1, B sub 1, C sub 1, D sub 1, E sub 1, F sub 1, followed by another such transformation with parameters A sub 2, B sub 2, C sub 2, D sub 2, E sub 2, F sub 2. The resulting transformation will still be of the form AF. A useful algebraic shortcut is to define a column vector, V, with components x, y, and rewrite the affine transformation as the complement of V equals capital A times V plus T, where capital A equals open parenthesis A, B, D, E, close parenthesis, is a 2x2 matrix, and T is a column vector with components C, F. A composition of two affine transformations, capital A sub 1, T sub 1, followed by capital A sub 2, T sub 2, is the affine transformation, capital A sub 2, capital A sub 1, capital A sub 2, T sub 1, plus T sub 2. Moreover, any affine transformation has a unique inverse, such that the composition of the transformation with its inverse is the identity transformation given by A equals E equals 1, B equals C equals D equals F equals 0. Therefore, it follows that the collection of all affine transformations forms a group. As the concept of a group plays a central role in our discussion, it is worth digressing to define it properly. A group is a set, capital G, together with an operation, star, is to capital G times capital G approaches capital G, that assigns an element H star G of capital G to any two elements, H and G, and such that the following three conditions hold. G1. There exists an element. E is an element of capital G called the identity, such that G star E equals E star G. For all, G is an element of capital G. G2. For any G is an element of capital G, there exists an inverse element, G to the power of negative 1, such that G star G to the power of negative 1 equals G to the power of negative 1 star G equals E. G3. For any elements H, G, K in capital G, H star open parenthesis G star K close parenthesis equals open parenthesis H star G close parenthesis star K. The third axiom G3 is called associativity. It need not concern us for the groups of transformation where the product star is defined by compositions of transformations. All transformations are associative. If G star H equals H star G for all elements of capital G, then the group capital G is called abelian. An example of an abelian group of transformations is the group consisting only of translations of a plane. Its identity element is the translation by the zero vector. The affine group AF is not abelian, as the matrix product is non-commutative. The German mathematician Felix Klein had the idea of defining a geometry as a pair consisting of a space, capital S, in our case capital S is the two-dimensional plane, and a group, capital G. In our case, this capital G is the group of all affine transformations of the plane, transforming points of capital S to other points of capital S. The subject of such geometry is the study of properties of shapes which do not change under the group transformations. In particular, the same space, capital S, can be a playground for different geometries if different groups are chosen. Klein published his work in 1872 when he worked in the city of Erlangen in Bavaria, and his program, active to this day, is named after this city. Let us see how the Euclidean geometry on a plane of the set of real numbers squared fits into this scheme. The underlying group consists of isometries, the transformations preserving the Pythagorean distance between points. The isometries of a plane are rotations, translations, and reflections. They are all special cases of the affine transformations, AF. An anticlockwise rotation by an angle theta around the origin corresponds to the transformation AF with A equals cos of theta, B equals negative sine of theta, C equals 0, D equals sine of theta, E equals cos of theta, F equals 0. A translation by a vector with components C, F is an affine transformation with A equals E equals 1, B equals D equals 0. The rotations and translations of a plane also form a group, called the Euclidean group. This group is smaller than the whole group of affine transformations. Any element of the Euclidean group is a composition of a rotation and a translation. Thus it is described by three parameters: the angle of rotation and the two components of a translation. A general affine transformation, AF, depends on six parameters, and it has fewer invariants, the things left unchanged by the transformations, than the Euclidean group. In general, the bigger the group capital G, the fewer invariants it has. Every invariant of the affine group is an invariant of the Euclidean group, but the converse is, as we have heard, not true. Is there any advantage in taking this seemingly complicated approach to the classical Euclidean geometry? By starting from the Euclidean group, we can recover distances and angles as its invariants, even if we did not know what they were in the first place. This approach, which determines a geometry from its allowed group of transformation, has proved very influential in many areas of mathematics and goes beyond geometry. Projective geometry. We devoted the whole of Chapter 5 to the projective geometry of perspective. Could this discussion have been shortened by putting the projective geometry in the framework of Klein's Erlangen program? As we have heard, the key is to identify a group of allowed transformations. While we are aiming for a projective geometry of the plane, the starting point will be the group of transformations of the 3 negative space of the set of real numbers cubed, taking a point capital P with coordinates capital X, capital Y, capital Z, to the complement of capital P with coordinates the complement of capital X, the complement of capital Y, the complement of capital Z, such that the complement of capital X equals A times capital X plus B times capital Y plus C times capital Z. The complement of capital Y equals D times capital X plus E times capital Y plus F times capital Z. The complement of capital Z equals G times capital X plus H times capital Y plus I times capital Z. Equivalently, using matrices, the complement of V equals capital A times V, where V is a vector with components capital X, capital Y, capital Z, and capital A is a 3x3 matrix. Capital A equals open parenthesis A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, close parenthesis. We shall moreover assume that rows of this matrix are independent, which means that, when regarded as vectors, they do not lie on a two-dimensional plane in the set of real numbers cubed. This class of transformations is called linear. It depends on 9 parameters, A, B, etc. until I, and is less general than the group of all affine transformations of the 3 space, as it does not contain any translations. In Chapter 5, we defined the projective plane, the set of real numbers times the symbol of capital P squared, as the space of lines through the origin in the set of real numbers cubed, and any such line is in turn defined by 2 ratios of the homogeneous coordinates. How are these ratios changed under our group of transformations? Let us assume for a moment that capital Z is not equal to 0, and define 2 ratios. X equals the fraction with the numerator capital X and the denominator capital Z prime, and Y equals the fraction with the numerator capital Y and the denominator capital Z prime. So that, setting the complement of X equals the complement of capital X divided by the complement of capital Z, the complement of Y equals the complement of capital Y divided by the complement of capital Z, we find the complement of X is equal to the fraction with the numerator A times X plus B times Y plus C and the denominator G times X plus H times Y plus I, and the complement of Y equals the fraction with the numerator D times X plus E times Y plus F and the denominator G times X plus H times Y plus I. This group of transformations is called the projective group. It transforms points on a plane and is bigger than the group of affine transformations. A general projective transformation depends on 8 parameters. It is not 9, as we have lost 1 parameter by taking ratios. For example, if I is not 0, then we can divide all the parameters of a projective transformation by I without changing the complement of X and the complement of Y. This has an effect of setting I equal to 1, and keeping the other 8 essential parameters in the transformation. A seemingly more serious problem immediately arises. While we have assumed that capital Z is not 0, we have not said anything about the complement of capital Z. Therefore, the denominator in the expressions for the complement of X and the complement of Y may vanish, and then a point with coordinates X, Y on the plane is transformed to infinity. However, this is exactly what we expect to see in projective geometry. The projective plane, the set of real numbers, times the symbol of capital P squared, consists of an ordinary plane, the set of real numbers squared, together with a line at infinity. By starting off with a group of projective transformations, we have rediscovered the need for this line at infinity. The space capital S, on which the projective transformations act, has to be a projective plane, or the transformations would make no sense. The Klein perspective deduced the projective plane purely from the set of transformations. The projective group of transformations contains the affine group. Therefore, every invariant of the projective group is also an invariant of the affine group, but not vice versa. Affine geometry is more restrictive than projective geometry. We have already shown that Euclidean geometry is in turn more restrictive than affine geometry. This point was emphasized by Klein, who recognized projective geometry as the most general of the three, from the perspective of the transformation groups. We can also illustrate what happens to a square with side 1 under Euclidean, affine, projective, and general continuous transformations using a diagram. Let us examine projective geometry in the simpler setup of a projective line. Our starting point is a linear transformation of a plane with coordinates capital X, capital Y. We define a projective line, the set of real numbers times the symbol of capital P to the power of 1, to be a set of lines through the origin in the plane. Any such line is determined by a ratio X equals capital X divided by capital Y, where we have assumed that capital Y is not equal to 0. These ratios inherit their transformation rules from those on a plane. The relevant group consists of transformations of the form capital M. The complement of X equals the fraction with the numerator A times X plus B and the denominator C times X plus D prime. Where A, B, C, D are parameters, such that A times D minus B times C is not equal to 0. These transformations are called Möbius, after the 19th century German mathematician August Möbius. We define the complement of X to be infinity if X equals negative D divided by C. So the arena for the projective transformations is capital S equals the set of real numbers plus open bracket infinity close bracket minus A. Line with a point at infinity added to it. This is exactly the projective line from chapter 5. What is it that we study in projective geometry of a projective line? In other words, are there any invariants of the group of projective transformations, capital M? It turns out that there is only one such invariant. Any point on a projective line is uniquely described by its coordinate, X, which we allow to be infinite. To any four points with coordinates x sub 1, x sub 2, x sub 3, x sub 4, we can associate with their cross ratio defined by open brackets x sub 1, x sub 2, x sub 3, x sub 4, close bracket, equals the fraction with the numerator open parenthesis x sub 1 minus x sub 3, close parenthesis, times open parenthesis x sub 2 minus x sub 4, close parenthesis, and the denominator open parenthesis x sub 1 minus x sub 4, close parenthesis, times open parenthesis x sub 2 minus x sub 3, close parenthesis. It is true, and may be checked by an explicit calculation, that although under projective transformations all four points change according to capital M, their cross ratio stays the same. Open bracket, the complement of x sub 1, the complement of x sub 2, the complement of x sub 3, the complement of x sub 4, close bracket, equals, open bracket, x1, x2, x3, x4, close bracket. Another way to phrase this is as follows. Any three points on a projective line can be mapped to any other three points by some transformation capital M. Therefore, we can choose a projective transformation which takes x sub 1, x sub 2, x sub 3, to infinity, 0, 1. This requirement fixes the projective transformation uniquely, and the point x sub 4 is mapped to a point whose coordinate is the cross ratio x sub 1, x sub 2, x sub 3, x sub 4. Given two quadruples of points, they will be related by a projective transformation if and only if they have the same cross ratios. Topology. The biggest group of transformations of a plane consists of all homeomorphisms. These are continuous maps like stretching, bending and twisting, but not tearing or gluing, which do not necessarily preserve distances or parallelism. So a cube and a sphere are homeomorphic in the three-dimensional space, but a donut is not homeomorphic to either of them. It has a hole which cannot be got rid of by a continuous transformation. The corresponding Klein geometry is called topology. It has so few invariants that it evolved into a separate field of mathematics and is not now regarded as a branch of geometry. It is therefore remarkable that some recent deep results in topology have been proved using techniques from geometry. The most prominent example may be Grigori Perelman's proof of the Poincaré conjecture. The conjecture, which was formulated in the early 20th century by the French mathematician Henri Poincaré, very roughly states that if capital S is three-dimensional space, which is finite in size, consists of one piece, has no boundary, and has an additional property that all closed loops in this space can be continuously deformed to a point, then capital S can be continuously deformed into the sphere x squared plus y squared plus z squared plus w squared equals 1 in the set of real numbers to the power of 4. Perelman's idea, which built on earlier work by Richard Hamilton, was to assume that the space capital S carries a notion of a curved Riemannian metric of the sort we discussed in Chapter 4. Once capital S is continuously deformed to another space, the metric also undergoes a deformation. By applying a tour de force analysis of the differential equation, the so-called Ricci flow, governing this metric deformation, Perelman was able to show that the metric evolves towards a metric of a constant Gaussian curvature, which can only exist on a sphere. He made his results available online in 2002 and 2003, but has never actually submitted them to a peer-reviewed journal. He has since withdrawn from mathematics and refused many honours and awards offered to him, including the Fields Medal and a $1 million Clay Millennium Prize. In Perelman's own words, "Everybody understood that if the proof is correct, then no other recognition is needed." Geometry of Fermat's Last Theorem. One of the most famous problems in mathematics, which remained unsolved until relatively recently, was to determine whether there exist three natural numbers, capital X, capital Y, and capital Z, such that capital X to the power of n plus capital Y to the power of n equals capital Z to the power of n, where n is a natural number greater than 2. The problem is known as Fermat's Last Theorem and was named after the 17th century French mathematician Pierre de Fermat, who wrote it in the margin of a book and stated that the margin was not big enough to include the marvellous proof that no such natural numbers exist. The problem remained unsolved for over 300 years until the British mathematician Sir Andrew Wiles presented a proof in 1995. The techniques used by Wiles belong to an area of algebraic geometry. While this book is not big enough to include his proof, I shall discuss the occurrence of geometry in the context of number theory. If we divide both sides of Fermat's equation by capital Z to the power of n, then the problem reduces to the question of whether there exist rational numbers, x equals capital X divided by capital Z, and y equals capital Y divided by capital Z, such that the equation x to the power of n plus y to the power of n equals 1 holds. This equation, when considered in Cartesian coordinates, x, y, gives a geometric shape known as a Fermat curve. To appreciate the role of geometry in all this, let us first focus on the Fermat curve with n equals 2, which is just a circle. Moreover, we know that integers capital X, capital Y, capital Z can be found in this case, as, for example, 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared. Triples of integers, such as 3, 4, 5, are called Pythagorean, as they appear as side lengths of a right-angled triangle. There are infinitely many such Pythagorean triples, so that there must be infinitely many points on the circle, x squared plus y squared equals 1, such that the coordinates x, y are rational numbers. Such points are called rational. Let us see how they can be constructed by a geometric argument. We shall use a mechanical analogy and regard the circle as a trajectory of a point moving on a plane, where the Cartesian coordinates x, y depend on time, t. Such a representation of a curve is called a parametrization. The parametrization we are seeking is rational, meaning that the functions x and y are ratios of polynomials in t. To obtain a rational parametrization, we shall identify points on the circle with their intersection with a straight line, L, passing through a fixed point on the circle. We shall choose this line to pass through the point negative 1, 0, so that x squared plus y squared equals 1, and y equals t times open parenthesis x plus 1 close parenthesis, where in the second equation, the gradient of the line L is given by a parameter t. To look for the points of intersection, substitute the second equation into the first. x2 plus t2 times open parenthesis x plus 1 close parenthesis squared equals 1. There are two solutions for x. The first one, x equals negative 1, corresponds to point negative 1, 0. The second one gives x equals the fraction with the numerator 1 minus t squared and the denominator 1 plus t squared, and y equals the fraction with the numerator 2t and the denominator 1 plus t squared, where the expression for y results from substituting x back into the equation of the line. The circle equation holds for all values of t because x squared plus y squared equals the fraction with the numerator 4t squared plus open parenthesis 1 minus t squared close parenthesis squared and the denominator open parenthesis 1 plus t squared close parenthesis squared equals 1. Let us now go back to the Pythagorean triples. If both x and y are rational numbers, then so is t equals y divided by open parenthesis x plus 1 close parenthesis. Conversely, if t equals p divided by q, where p, q are integers, then x equals the fraction with the numerator p squared minus q squared and the denominator p squared plus q squared, and y equals the fraction with the numerator 2p times q and the denominator p squared plus q squared are rational. As x and y have the same denominator, we can recover the Pythagorean triple as capital X equals p squared minus q squared, capital Y equals 2pq, capital Z equals p squared plus q squared. Substituting integer values of p, q into these expressions gives infinitely many triples, the first few of which are 3, 4, 5, 5, 12, 13, 8, 15, 17, 7, 24, 25, 20, 21, 29, and so on. It is remarkable that, apart from a few mistakes, a long list of such triples appears on a Babylonian clay tablet known as Plimpton 322, dated around 1800 BC, 1200 years before Pythagoras of Samos. It is not clear how the Babylonians found their triples, nor what they used them for. This construction suggests a way of disproving Fermat's last theorem. If we find rational parameterizations of Fermat curves with n is greater than 2, then by substituting integer values of t, the integers capital X, capital Y, capital Z could be found which satisfy Fermat's equation. Given that we now know Fermat's last theorem to be true, something must be wrong with this argument. And indeed it is. First, it is not too hard to show, at the level of an undergraduate course in algebraic geometry, that these Fermat curves do not admit a rational parameterization. If we tried to find such a parameterization by intersecting the Fermat curve with a line through a fixed point on this curve, The method before would lead to a certain polynomial equation of degree n. The procedure of finding the roots of this equation cannot be accomplished by factorization. In 1983, the German mathematician Gerd Faltings proved that curves given, like the Fermat curve, by vanishing of a polynomial in x and y of degree n, have at most finitely many rational points if n is greater than 3. This implies that there may only be finitely many integers, capital X, capital Y, capital Z, satisfying the Fermat relation, if n is greater than 3. This was the closest anyone came to proving Fermat's last theorem, until in 1995, when Andrew Wiles showed that the number of such integers is in fact 0. Faltings was awarded the Fields Medal, one of the highest prizes a mathematician can receive, for the proof of several theorems, including the one stated before. Fields medals are awarded every 4 years, to up to 4 mathematicians under the age of 40. Andrew Wiles was 42 years old at the time when the correct version of his proof was announced, and therefore missed out on a medal. A careful listener would have noticed that the case when n equals 3 appears to be special. The existence of infinitely many rational points is not excluded by the Faltings result. The statement of Fermat's last theorem for n equals 3 predates Fermat by over 600 years. It was noted by the 10th century Persian astronomer Al-Qujandi. Al-Qujandi's attempted proof of the theorem was incorrect. A correct proof was established by Leonhard Euler in 1760. The example of the Fermat curves suggests an exciting possibility that algebraic geometry may be of service to mathematics and offer ways of solving long-standing problems with its techniques. A slight drawback is that in the second half of the 20th century, algebraic geometers have, in search of rigour, developed a technical and hermetic language. They now have a reputation among other mathematicians similar to that which mathematicians have among non-mathematicians. This, in turn, was well summarised by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Mathematicians are like Frenchmen. Whatever you say to them, they translate into their own language, and forthwith it is something entirely different. The Polish-Jewish mathematician Hugo Steinhaus included the following problem in his collection of recreational mathematics problems aimed at non-specialists. Problem of Steinhaus. Does there exist a square with integer sides and a point capital P in the plane of this square, such that the 4 distances from capital P to the vertices of the square are integers? Steinhaus included solutions to all problems from his collection, except the one before, which he admitted he did not know how to solve. By introducing a Cartesian coordinate system, the listener will, with little difficulty, translate this problem into the statement about the existence of rational solutions to a number of quadratic equations. It is not known whether any such solutions exist.